Good morning. The court calls United States v. Hornback. Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant David Jankowski, and I represent the appellant, Private Hornback. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I request 2 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's no excuse for offending twice once the court has ruled upon the matter. Yet here, trial counsel offended 22 times, despite 15 instructions from the military judge telling her to stop. She repeatedly introduced improper character evidence, disparaged the accused, invoked the intent of the convening authority, and elicited hearsay evidence, irrelevant evidence, and facts not in evidence. This court should reverse the lower court because this misconduct was severe, the curative instructions were insufficient, and the government's case was far from strong.
What did the judge not do that he should have done? You alluded to instructions, but what else? What did the judge, it sounds like the judge was all over the trial counsel. What should the judge have done that he didn't do?
Judge Stuckey, I think there's two ways to answer that question, and the first way is to answer that he couldn't have done anything. Given the fact that this misconduct permeated the entire trial, it eclipsed 421 pages of a 557-page record of trial. The military judge simply could not have given an instruction that would have cured this.
Wait, he said he couldn't do anything. Couldn't he have done a mistrial or something?
Certainly.
Or called in more senior counsel and said, fix this problem?
Yes, Your Honor, he could have done that. Under his sua sponte powers, he could have declared a mistrial. But he could have also cited specific statements of the trial counsel that he found objectionable after the trial counsel invoked.
Well, he practically gave her a course in direct examination. He ended up in a 39A telling her what to ask. Is that even proper?
Your Honor, in a military judge's position where he has some sort of supervisory authority over counsels in the courtroom, it may have been proper given the fledgling nature of this trial counsel. But what the military judge did or did not do is counseled by the fact that he was caught off guard by the trial counsel's misconduct. He even noted, for example, at Joint Appendix 107, that I'm surprised by this, trial counsel. I've had insufficient time to consider it because you've given no 404B notice. And nevertheless, the trial counsel, over the course of six of her own witnesses, government witnesses, elicited improper character evidence on at least 15 different occasions.
Did the defense counsel ask for a mistrial?
No, he did not, Judge Ryan.
Okay. I guess what my question is it sounds like you're saying that there should be a per se rule that if there's X number of missteps by the government trial counsel, that therefore there must be reversal.
No, Your Honor. Counsel for appellant is not arguing for a per se rule. And if this court
doesn't... Well, if there's nothing that the military judge could have done and you base it on the pervasive nature of the comments, it sounds like that's exactly what you're asking for.
No, Your Honor, because there's no telling what precise number or what precise quantity of questions or quality of questions or improper argument could make this.
What about the impact on the trial itself? What about that portion of the test that you need to satisfy?
Yes, Your Honor.
When answering that question, I'd like you to address the findings of not guilty that were included in the member's decision.
Yes, Your Honor. So under this court's precedent in United States v. Fletcher, there's three factors for prejudice. Here, under severity, the raw numbers alone do demonstrate acute severity. There's at least 22 occasions where trial counsel committed misconduct. But this misconduct was not isolated as in Fletcher. It did permeate the entire trial.
We understand your argument about that prong of Fletcher. Go on to the other two.
Yes, Your Honor. So even if this court does not adopt a rule that says this misconduct could not have been cured, still the military judge's instructions were insufficient because on at least six different occasions he failed to give a curative instruction. So, for example, when GM3 Robidar testified that the accused became, quote, very combative, he merely ordered the members out, conducting yet another 39A. When Corporal Morris testified that there was a drastic change in how appellant acted as a roommate, again, he only sustained the testimony there. And then when trial counsel argued that the accused is a criminal infection that is a plague on the Marine Corps, twice, in fact, during her closing argument, The military judge, again, only sustained the objection, not give a curative instruction. So even if this court does look to the curative nature of these instructions, here they simply were insufficient to neutralize this misconduct. And further, the UCI instruction, which was given after the trial counsel stated, and the command has taken action in the form of these charges, and the government's confident that you will find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. There, the military judge did not note any of the specific statements of trial counsel, because the Ninth Circuit in Weatherspoon and the First Circuit in United States v. Ayala Garcia have noted that specific statements that the military judge or in those cases that the trial court finds objectionable ought to be included in a targeted curative instruction.
Well, didn't he give a kind of sweep-up instruction? You know, members, there's been a whole lot of this to do. Remember, listen to me, disregard all this stuff. That's not enough.
That's not enough here, Your Honor, because under Weatherspoon and Ayala Garcia, and indeed under Donnelly v. DiCristoforo, a case the government cites in its brief, the Supreme Court there affirmed the conviction where the judge noted the specific objectionable statements in the curative instruction. So he did try to do a curative instruction here. He tried to sweep it up, but he failed to sufficiently sweep it up because the specific objectionable statements, for example, that the accused became bad, that is a criminal infection that's a plague upon the Marine Corps.
But counsel, how do you justify saying that it failed to do any good when they found him not guilty of some of the charges? You'd like us to assume that they failed to follow the military judge's instructions, right? I mean, that's
what you want
us to say. But the findings worksheet doesn't reflect that.
Your Honor, the findings worksheet reflects an acquittal rate of 5 out of 8 charges. But here, that counsels in favor of a ruling that this case was a weak one, not that this case was a fair one. And a contrary holding by this court would send a signal to trial counsel that in weak cases, it's worth the risk to employ these improper tactics to turn what could be a total acquittal into a partial one. And we know that's a real risk here because trial counsel on page Joint Appendix 94 actually asked the military judge to admit erroneous evidence, noting that it was found harmless on appeal.
And is there a presumption that members follow the judge's instruction unless there's a demonstrated otherwise?
Yes, Your Honor.
In this record indicates that members, we should not adhere to that presumption?
The persistent and pronounced misconduct, Your Honor, and under United States v. Crutchfield, an 11th Circuit case, which is persuasive here, this court should note that this misconduct here eclipsed 6 different government witnesses, each critical stage of the trial before the members, opening, case in chief.
But doesn't that go to the sort of severity of the misconduct? What about the presumption? There's 3 million examples of improper argument. We'll stipulate in my ridiculous hypothetical, okay? So there's no question about that. And the judge gives the perfect curative instruction after the 3 million errors. Don't we still look to the presumption that members are supposed to follow the judge's instruction unless there's some indication they did not?
Yes, Your Honor, but what's important is under United States v. Fletcher, these factors all balance against one another. And for example, in Moore v. Morton, a Third Circuit case under habeas review, the Third Circuit noted the, quote, very strong curative instructions that were given by the judge there. But because the misconduct was so severe, as it is here, and because the government's case is far from strong, as it is here, the court nevertheless reversed despite those strong curative instructions. So it is important to still balance these factors against one another.
I'm not quite sure I understand what you're arguing. You're certainly arguing that, as the chief judge said, there are 3 million examples of, I won't say intentional misconduct, but at the very least, lack of experience and lack of knowledge. But you said in answer to an earlier question to Judge Ryan that there's no numerical quantum that somehow overcomes the presumption that the members follow the judge's instructions. But now you seem to be arguing precisely that this is so bad that it stinks per se and we should reverse to send a message. Well, sending a message isn't our function. Reversing for legal error may be our function, but sending a message isn't. So what are you asking for?
Your Honor, I'm not asking for this court to send a message. That's simply in response to the government's argument that the partial acquittal demonstrates fairness, not weakness. In response to Judge Ryan's question, I do note that there's no numeric quantity that could overcome or tell this court, aha, at 15 instances or at 20 instances, a structural error. What appellant does argue as its primary position is that the curative instructions here would be insufficient, whereas in Crutchfield, the misconduct permeates the entire trial. But even if this court does not adopt the holding in Crutchfield as persuasive authority, it can still find that these instructions on this record were insufficiently curative.
In Crutchfield, was there an acquittal on any of the counts of the indictment?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that there were.
And in Crutchfield, wasn't it very obvious that it was completely intentional, bad, wrong misconduct on areas that they specifically told them not to go into, such as, you know, the sexual behavior of the defendant, which had nothing to do with the iguanas?
Yes, Your Honor, there was evidence of intent there, but here on the United States v. Evans, this court looks to the fairness of the trial, not the culpability of the prosecutor. And as the Third Circuit noted in United States v. Nettles, it hurts a defendant just as much when the prejudicial blasts come from the trumpet of the angel Gabriel.
Right. So and I understand all that, but we have a test that's laid out in Fletcher that gives us different things to balance, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And the Crutchfield court didn't do that sort of balancing, did it? It was just angry at what the prosecutor did.
No, it did not. But certainly the Third Circuit in the Morton case, despite finding the strong curative instructions, balanced the prosecutorial misconduct, which was severe, against the weakness of the case and against the what it found to be strong curative instructions, and it's still reversed. And indeed, in United States v. Beeks, an Eighth Circuit case, there the defense counsel actually agreed that the trial judge had given the proper curative instruction, and still the Eighth Circuit reversed because, like this court does, it balanced the factors against the severe misconduct and against the far from strong government case.
Well, counsel, let's talk about that third factor from Fletcher, the weight of evidence. And I certainly understand your arguments as to the spice charge, and I think the military judge even mentioned the lack of evidence there. But what about the false official statement in the larceny charges? Wasn't there direct evidence as to those charges?
Yes, Your Honor, there was Prosecution Exhibit 3, but importantly, the point of entry for Prosecution Exhibit 3 into the Marine Corps Total Force System, Lance Corporal Rios, never testified. The government did not introduce him into evidence. He was not able to testify that whether or not he asked, for example, Private Hornback, is your wife a Marine? So that evidence was not there. And moreover, trial counsel specifically made an objectionable statement with reference to Prosecution Exhibit 3. She stated, this is the most simple form I've ever seen, and on the next page, I believe it's Joint Appendix 243, she stated, look at this dumbed-down form, suggesting that there's no way that Private Hornback could have made a benign input error.
And in fact, without getting into whether or not that was an objectionable, I guess my question is, how is that even an objectionable statement?
Well, it's an unsolicited personal opinion, Your Honor, that it's a dumbed-down form and that it's the most simple form
so,
that I
so
have ever
seen.
So
if a trial counsel says, members, you know, this is an open and shut case, this is good, this is an easy case, I mean, that's a personal opinion. Is that error?
No, it's not error, Your Honor, because that can be tethered to the evidence. Here, she's using her personal pronouns, which this court found objectionable in United States v. Fletcher.
And so we should find constitutional error because someone said that a form was simple.
No, Your Honor, this court should find constitutional error because that error, in addition to the cumulative impact of the improper character evidence, in addition to the cumulative impact with invoking the intent of the convening authority, counsels in favor of reversal. The government is mistaken. In page 33 of its brief, it says that these errors taken individually are not misconduct. But this court does not take those errors individually. Under Fletcher, it takes them cumulatively. And here, given the severity of the misconduct, weighed against the insufficient curative instructions and weighed against a far from strong government case, this court should reverse the lower court and set aside the findings and sentence.
Do you think the Fletcher test is a good test and the one we should apply in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, and that's primarily because even if this court adopts appellant's position in Crutchfield, and applies Crutchfield, that still does not alter the Fletcher test. Fletcher asks whether or not the curative instructions were sufficient. So here, given the pervasiveness of this misconduct, the fact that it...
No, I get that argument. I'm just making sure that, and I'll ask the government the same argument, that the Fletcher test has stood the test of time, and the three factors are the correct three factors. We're not missing an additional factor. We shouldn't eliminate one of them.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The Fletcher test stands the test of time. And here it counsels in favor of reversal. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. I'm Colonel Stephen C. Newman, United States Marine Corps, and I, along with Mr. Brian Hill, represent the United States on this matter. This court should affirm the decision of the lower court for three primary reasons. First, rebuttal and sentencing errors were unobjective, were not clear error, and were forfeited.
Counsel, before you get into error, what's going on here? This girl gets sent into this trial. Obviously totally untrained, obviously not knowing what she's doing, without evidently the help of any senior counsel or anything. By the admission of both sides, you know, this trial's a mess. Where was the supervision? What's going on here?
So the record doesn't reflect where the supervision was in this particular case. I think the record does reflect that this trial counsel could have used some supervision.
Which she didn't get.
I would say, Your Honor, that she did get supervision from the military judge, who had a very active and engaged...
Yeah, you had an active and engaged military judge telling her what to say. Is that proper?
It is, Your Honor.
How?
It's proper because the military judge is a sentinel of the courtroom.
He's a sentinel, but he's not a party.
No, Your Honor, but I don't think in this case the military judge crossed that line. The instructions that he gave to the...
Well, I'm not talking about the instruction. I'm talking about when he told her in excruciating detail what questions to ask on direct examination.
I understand, Your Honor. And my response to that is that he didn't cross a line there because it occurred outside of the hearing of the members. In fact, the fact that he's supervising her to such a degree, in some ways, actually favors us because it showed that he was engaged in this case. It shows to the level of detail that of attention he paid to the trial counsel.
It shows the depth to which he had to go to try and bail this proceeding out.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't phrase it that way. I would suggest that the military judge would properly preserve the record, serve his roles as a sentinel of military justice, and took action and intervened where necessary.
Would you agree that the military judge intervened 15 times, called 739A sessions, and that there are 12 incidents in which Rule 404B was violated?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that there are
15. You agree with that count?
Yes, Your Honor. I think appellant's count, total of 22 errors, 22 allegations of error in this case is correct, 15 of which related to sustained objections. And if you look at the sustained objections and you look at the master curative instruction found in Joint Appendix 234, the military judge immediately tied all those sustained objections up.
Does there come a time, and obviously you haven't found it in this case, but is there ever a time in the view of the government that there are so many improper comments, statements, or introduction of evidence that a curative instruction will not, in fact, cure the matter?
No, Your Honor. There is a point in time where there's structural error, which would require per se reversal. There is a time where there's constitutional error, but in a case like this...
But there's no number of times that you can introduce improper character evidence that cannot be cured by a judge, saying, don't listen to that.
In that regard, Your Honor, I would refer you to Meek and the test that the court established in Meek with regard to prosecutorial misconduct. And what that test first tells you to do is to look first at each individual norm violation. And then, after examining each after determining that the instances did indeed violate a norm, then look to see if there is error prejudicial to a substantial right. And then following that, in the context of the entire record, look to see if the error was harmless. So in answer to your question, you first look...
So it sounds like the answer might be, in fact, there is a circumstance where a proper instruction cannot cure the matter, but you have to look at that record in context.
Yes, Your Honor.
So an instruction does not per se cure all error.
But in this case, it did, Your Honor.
No, I understand. Yeah, no, I get that point.
And error can be extinguished by a military judge's instructions.
So you were just conceding that we should look at these errors cumulatively at the end of the day?
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting that this Court should do is apply the first look at each individual allegation raised by the appellant, 22 instances, and strip away those which do not result in error prejudicial to a substantial right, and then weighing and balancing the factors as laid out in Fletcher, rule in favor of the United States, because the military judge's curative instruction neatly sewed up all of those objections, neatly sewed tied up all those.
You agree that Fletcher factors have stood the test of time, they're sound, and those are the factors we should address when we get to the prejudice piece?
Yes, Your Honor. Fletcher factors are largely in keeping with a lot of other federal case law on the issue, but Fletcher needs to be read in view of Meek, which first asks whether there was a norm violation. If there was a norm violation, second, whether that norm violation...
What are we supposed to do about the norm violation when we have a CCA opinion that just assumed that there was a norm violation every time that one was alleged, and then moved on to say that it was not error sufficient to require reversal?
Well, cases of prosecutorial misconduct, Your Honor, are a mixed case of fact and law, and this Court views those de novo, so the Court can feel free to look into the joint appendix record and look at those issues on its own and make its own determination independent of what the CCA Court did. And in this case, if you look at the record, there were 22 instances alleged by the appellant, 15 of which led to sustained objections by the military judge. Those sustained objections were each highlighted by the military judge in his master curative instruction in Joint Appendix 234.
In terms of the outer limits that I think Chief Judge Baker was asking about, would this case be any different, in your view, if there had been no findings of not guilty? How would that weigh in terms of our analysis?
Your Honor, I think it would weigh the severity analysis in Fletcher. It would indicate that maybe there was something taken back to the members' deliberation room. But the question this Court asked in that regard is whether the members' verdict would have been different in the absence of that error. And in this case, we have...
Well, I understand that you would like us to adopt the fourth prong of Olano and continue on that road, but let's assume that we're applying the law at this Court and the UCMJ articles as they stand.
Yes, Your Honor. The fact is that in this case, what went back to the deliberation room were 8 specifications. And what came back was guilty findings to 3. And on those 3 specifications, the government's evidence was strong. The evidence of the spice use was strong because there were 2 witnesses who said they saw their behavior using spice, that he came in with spice in a container.
The evidence was strong, notwithstanding the military judge's comments 5 times that one aspect of the evidence or another was weak.
The military judge made that one comment that the evidence was weak, but in context of the record in that 39A section where that occurred, he was talking about that one piece of evidence that the government was trying to offer, that it was not strong evidence.
I will tell you this is not a strong case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he say that?
But that reflects the members' findings.
But you just said it was a strong case.
It was a strong case of the spice use.
Okay, so that was on the Xanax?
Xanax, yes, Your Honor, which he was acquitted.
And then this evidence is so weak as the spice one, but you're saying that's only with respect to Robidart's testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look at that, the testimony of GM3 Robidart, Pelham brought that to the Court's attention during his argument, that testimony was bookended by 2 curative instructions. 2 separate distinct curative instructions, both of which told members to disregard the testimony and both of which was read in context of the entire record, and the master curative instruction showed that there was no error prejudicial to the appellant.
Now, counsel, you talk about the need to find a normative, a norm violation. How does that square with Supreme Court in Smith versus Phillips, where they were saying we need to focus on the issue of the culpability of the prosecutor, not on that, but instead on the fairness of the trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Intent and culpability are factors that this Court should consider. But intent and culpability are not necessarily dispositive. I believe that, for example, if a trial counsel were to commit a Brady violation by accident, or to commit a Brady Act violation intentionally, the effect would be the same. But the intent is a matter that this Court should consider, but in this case, there's no evidence of intent. There's evidence, as Judge Stuckey pointed out, of a trial counsel who perhaps needs some supervision.
But at the end of the day, don't we come down to the issue of looking at the fairness of the trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Fairness of the trial in relation to this appellant. And in view of the entire record.
Counsel, can you give me an example? Obviously, you don't think it's this case. What is an example where it would reach the level of structural error?
If the appellant's if the trial counsel had interfered with the appellant's right to counsel,
Sure. Are you saying it's essentially that no evidentiary problems like these,
right,
however high the pile, can ever reach structural error? You're saying it has to be of a different sort?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that what we have here is just pure trial error, mm-hmm, as opposed to structural or constitutional.
And then the question is prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Which is reviewed for plain error on the unobjected to material and harmlessness on the...
Right. Most of it was objected to.
Yes,
so,
Your Honor.
So it's not plain error.
But there were four instances that went unobjected.
Right.
The first was the opening statement with regards to drugs, decay, and dishonesty. The two instances that the appellant identifies as vouching and the use of the convening authority's name on sentence, or committing the police entirely on sentence. In each of those cases, the error there was not clear. For example, the opening statement, drugs, decay, and dishonesty. That theme was rationally related to the evidence that was presented at trial. The case was about drug use. It's about a new emerging threat to our military, synthetic cannabinoids, and the like. And the theme of drugs, decay, and dishonesty, in addition to the PAH fraud, was rationally related to the trial counsel's evidence. Even so, the question becomes, would the member's verdict be any different without that one sentence? The evidence of the drug use was strong, and Corporal Powers and Ms. Carney, both of whom testified they saw the appellant smoking. That opening statement is bookended by two separate curative instructions, Joint Appendix 64 and Joint Appendix 69. So the error there was extinguished. The voucher. The dependency application. First, it's not clear because it was in fair reply to the trial defense counsel's closing, where he brought into question the form itself and implied that it was confusing. That's in Joint Appendix 239. Second, it's not clear because if she vouched for anything, she vouched for the simplicity of the form. And finally, I would point this court to United States versus Horn, where this court has said that the mere use of personal pronouns is not in and of itself vouching. And again, the evidence on that form was strong. The false official statement was strong. We had the testimony of Chief Warren Officer Greg Easton in the form itself. The vouching from Corporals Kelly and Morris. Again, it was not clear because it was fair reply. The trial defense counsel had called their veracity into question, essentially bringing into question their whether or not they lied because of their loyalty to one another. And just like in Thomas, it would be unusual not to expect the trial counsel to reply in kind. Finally, the appellant was acquitted of that particular specification, which was related to the larceny of the camera phones. So again, it's not clear. And then the argument on the UCI. It's not clear because she didn't clearly invoke the convening authority. She merely listed the convening authority's interest in good order and discipline, an issue on which the members were instructed as a principle of sentencing at Joint Appendix 290. Also, even should this court find that that was error and did prejudice the appellant, this court should tailor its relief to the error. In this case, it occurred on sentencing. As such, this court should either remand for resentencing him or return to the lower court for reassessment of sentence, not reverse the fines because it was one error in sentencing.
Counsel, I asked the appellant's counsel about the failure to ask for a mistrial. In your view, would their case be stronger if they had asked for a mistrial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before prosecution, that we didn't get a fair trial.
Yes, Your Honor, I think it would. I think it would be stronger if they had asked for a mistrial and if they were raising ineffective assistance as another claim here against the trial defense counsel for failing to object on the closing argument. As we discussed, this error can be broken down into two different separate categories. First, the preserved error, and second, the unpreserved error. We discussed the unpreserved error. I want to move now very briefly to the preserved error. As I mentioned, the test here is found in Meek. And again, as I mentioned, if you ask whether there's a moral violation and whether that violation prejudices the substantial right of the appellant, and then in view of the whole record, whether it was harmless. It's important to remember that even where there were norm violations, a mere deviation from a rule is not enough to show error. And it's appellant's burden to show that the improper conduct, both the improper conduct and the prejudice, Fourth Circuit and Eleventh Circuit have found that it's the appellant's burden to show not just that there was a norm violation, but also the conduct that's alleged prejudiced the appellant. Another case to look at is United States v. Leiden, where the error was, where it says that the error based on 404B, the test for error based on 404B is for harmlessness and whether the court can say with fair assurance that the error did not affect the member's verdict. Again, we had 15 trial objections here, all sustained, and all neatly stitched together by the military judge's master curative instruction. Six instances relate to charges for which there was an acquittal. The appellant points to no evidence, and the United States is aware of it, that the members failed to follow those instructions. We believe the fact that they acquitted on five of the eight specifications. In view of the curative instructions, we get to the JPD call.
Counsel, do you perhaps see some irony in that you're asking this court to find that the panel members followed the judge's instructions when, in fact, the trial counsel didn't always follow the judge's instructions?
Irony, I suppose, yes, Your Honor. But I think that a fair read of the record shows that she did follow the military judge's instructions. Specifically, some specific examples where the trial counsel obeyed the military judge. Joint Appendix 188-189, Corporal Morris. The language that the appellant alleges as error was where she asked trial counsel, asked Corporal Morris if I would like to discuss the matter of your BAH. This drew an objection, which was sustained. Far from disobeying the military judge, the trial counsel simply told the military judge that she had nothing further at that time and passed the witness to the defense counsel. Sustained objections have to be viewed in the context of the master curative instruction.
Now, what about the situation where the trial counsel argued the accused is like a criminal infection that is a plague to the Marine Corps? The objection was sustained, and then she continued, he became that infection.
Yes, Your Honor. We would agree that in that particular instance, that she shouldn't have said those things. But we would also suggest that the military judge in his master curative instruction took care of that, and that the members clearly abided by that instruction because they acquitted on the 5B8 specifications.
Even though the trial counsel didn't comply with the judge's order.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but again, I remind the court that mere violation of the norm is not enough. There has to be error prejudicial to a substantial right concomitant to that norm violation. And then the court has to look at the entire record in the context of the entire record to determine whether that error was harmless. In this case, because of the master curative instruction, because of the six other instructions that the military judge rendered in the course of this trial, clearly there was no prejudice to this panel.
How would a... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, please. There's time for everybody.
Does the government agree with the CCA's assumption that there was misconduct?
Well, Your Honor, we don't agree that there was error prejudicial to a substantial right, but we do agree that there were instances where this trial counsel stepped outside of the line.
But do you agree that all 22 instances that the appellant is alleging?
Not all of them, no, Your Honor. Some of them, and I think our brief highlights those where we disagree, but...
Well, do you agree with the CCA's action in assuming misconduct and then moving on to the prejudicial analysis?
There's nothing in this court's jurisprudence or in the jurisprudence of the lower court which prevents us from doing that.
No, I agree with that. I'm just asking whether or not you agree with the action that they took.
I understand the question now, Your Honor. Well, I think what the court should have done is applied me and first looked to see whether there was a known violation. Second, looked to see whether there's a known violation. Look at the individual to see if I see my time's about to expire.
You certainly can answer these questions.
Whether there's known violations for error prejudicial to a substantial right, and then in the context of the whole record.
But I still don't think I've gotten an answer to my question. The CCA proceeded on the basis that they assumed there was misconduct. Do you agree with that determination by the CCA? Their assumption.
Well, Your Honor, again, I know I'm not answering, I'm not scratching Your Honor's itch, but...
It's kind of a yes or no question.
We would agree that the trial counsel violated norms here. But what we don't agree is that those norms were errors to the point where they prejudiced a substantial right.
Well, yeah. I think you've answered my question.
Yep, Judge Olson.
Now, under Meek, that you're talking about here, you say first you have to find that a norm is violated, then the appellant has the burden to show that he or she was prejudiced. Can you give us some examples of how an appellant would show that he or she has been prejudiced and what that prejudice would consist of?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that an example would... I believe a finding of guilty as to those specifications would help. I believe that in this case, it's pretty clear that some of the norms that were violated, including the use of the criminal infection and the quote from Napoleon Bonaparte, those were all clearly norm violations. However, in view of the master curative instruction, they didn't result in prejudice. So I think you have to look in the context of the record. It's hard to come up with a specific example, particularly in this case, because the military judge did such a good job instructing them.
But Judge Olson's question was... That's a fair argument. Give us some examples of when we would spot prejudice. What should we be looking for if we're looking for prejudice in another case?
I think the factors laid out in Fletcher give us quite a good framework for that. The severity of the conduct, the...
You follow? Let's say there's a... It's your question. There's a curative instruction, the perfect curative instruction. How do we know if there's prejudice nonetheless? Not in this case, but in a case.
The only way I can answer that question, Your Honor, is to say by looking at the entire record in context and applying the severity analysis from Fletcher, the number of the errors, the misconduct that was confined to one particular part of the record, the length of the trial, and the panel's deliberation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel. Now we have a rebuttal. Had to sort that out.
Your Honors, appellant just has two quick points in reply pending this court's further questions. First, contrary to what the government contends, decay is not rationally related to the charges here. Webster's defines decay as rot or decomposition. And when that word is tethered to dishonesty and drugs, it shows the trial counsel's focus on the accused's character, which in turn shows his propensity to commit crime. That's what infections do. Infections spread. So when an infection spreads, it shows that this accused is more likely to commit more crime, which increases the danger that the members are going to have their prejudices, prejudice and passions unduly inflamed. And that is why that particular comment is not rationally related, and that is why it's improper. And secondly, to the extent that this court finds plain error in some of the instances of misconduct which were not objected to, this court should still weigh those examples cumulatively against those preserved errors, as the First Circuit did in Ayala Garcia.
Can I just ask you one quick question, and if you can answer it simply, that would be great. What specifically would you point to as to what the impact of misconduct was on this trial? How do we know that there was an impact on the trial?
Your Honor, we know that from the convictions here. We cannot be sure, based on this record, that the members convicted appellant on only the evidence and not based on the improper colloquies that trial counsel elicited from her own witnesses or her improper argument. So it's the convictions themselves. And unless this court has any further questions, that concludes appellant's argument.
Okay, thank you. The court thanks both counsel, and we will stand in recess until 10:25.
All right. The court stands in recess until 10:25.